Okay. Welcome. I feel bad, like, being happy about learning Eicha. There's something wrong with that. But it is still a book in Tanakh. And it will be, even after there's no more Tisha B'Av, it'll still be a book in Tanakh. So last week we talked about the question of why there's a book of Eicha at all. What is this sefer about? What's it trying to accomplish? We pointed out that other books in Tanakh have very clear roles. Right? Some of them are history books, which Eicha is not, because it doesn't describe any particular event in time. Some of them provide predictions of future events, Yeshaya, Yirmiyah, Yechezkel, Daniel, books like that. There's no prediction of a future event in Eicha. Some of them provide advice. Mishlei is a book that has advice in it. Koheles has a book if it has advice in it. There's no advice given in Eicha. There is a little bit of tefillah. There's a little bit of davening of prayer going on in Eicha, but not a whole lot. Most of the book is not that either. And what we developed is the idea that Yirmiyahu, as the author, is meant to represent the Jew who has experienced Churban, the Jew who has experienced this kind of desolation and destruction. We talked about how Yirmiyahu represents the Jew. We talked about him in terms of the fact that he's uncertain of himself as a Navi when Hashem approaches him. He says, I'm a kid, no one's going to take me seriously, which is a theme we've noticed with other Nevi'im as well, but also the way he suffers, the way that they really don't take him seriously. When they do take him seriously, it's with antagonism. They throw him in a pit, they want to kill him, they mock him. He deals, I think more than any other Navi, he deals with false Nevi'im who tell the kings exactly what the kings want to hear and the opposite of what Yirmiyahu is saying. And at one point he wants to give up, more than one point he wants to give up. He curses the day he was born, something we're more familiar with from Eov. He wants to stop, and he says, but I can't. Hashem keeps sending me these messages, and I have to convey them to the people. And Yirmiyahu is this person who suffers ridicule and pain and exile, much as the Jews do ultimately in their Churban. And so we're meant to learn from what he expresses in order to develop our own reaction to Churban, to destruction and loss. And that's more or less what we did last time. We talked about some of the themes of the Sefer as well, and started on the structure of it. And that's where we're going to pick up to talk about structure, and then the images of the Sefer itself. So we said there are five chapters, right? Hopefully that's not a surprise. There are five prakim in the book. We noted that they tend to have the alphabetical acrostic, where the first parak, the second parak, and the fourth one are straightforward. Aleph, Bet, Gimel, Dalet, except for switching Pei and Ayin at certain points within the Sefer. We noted that the third parak has these sets of three psukim. So it's Aleph, 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 Bet, 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 Gimel, 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 down the line. We talked a little bit about the significance of the alphabetical structure. Two other notes, though, in terms of this. First of all, the arc of the book, is there any sort of development in the course of the book of Eicha? Like, you start here and then end there? And the answer is maybe. The first two prakim, the first two chapters, focus on describing suffering, describing isolation, but Perek Bet is much more forceful than Perek Aleph. So, for example, if you take a look in an Eicha, you'll see what I mean. If you take a look at the opening sentence versus Perek Bet Pasuk Ted. Okay, so if you take a look at you know, first sentence in the Sefer, and you have the Jews described, or you have Yerushalayim described as Ha'ir Rabasi'am, the city that had once had many people living there, Ha'isak Almana, now is like a widow, Rabasi Vagoyim, I have been great among the nations, Sarasi Bamedinos, she had been, the Yud, don't get confused by the Yud at the end of Rabasi and Sarasi, it's not personal, it's not I, it's she who was great among the nations, leader in the Medinot. The Haisalamas is now tribute to the others. But take a look at that versus what you see. is in Perek Beis Pasuk Tes, the not just that the city is which had been great is now alone. I'm looking to see what I meant when I reference this, because now even I'm not seeing what it was that I was pointing out. That happens sometimes. Right, there is a parallel in that, but that's not what I was looking for. Chalk it up to a mistake in my own notes. But take a look instead at Pasuk Yud Aleph. I'll give you a different contrast between the second pasuk in it, B'chosiv kebalayla v'dimasa lechia, the second sentence in the book, and then Perek Beis Pasuk Yud Aleph, because that one I do see. B'chosiv kebalayla, she cries at night, v'dimasa lechia, and her tears are on her cheek, right? And then we go to Pasuk Yud Aleph, it's kalu v'dimaos einai chamar meru me'ai. My eyes are gone with tears. Her insides melt. Nishpach laretz kvedi. My liver is poured out on the ground. The liver image, with what you will. But it's a much more dramatic phrase, right? Where in Pasuk Beis, she cries at night. In Perek Beis, it's my eyes are gone with tears. It's stronger than in Perek Aleph. The Dan Mikra edition does more of these parallels between the first and the second, in the way the second is more intense than the first. But fundamentally, the first two prakim are suffering, isolation, grief. The third parak is much more about punishment and how Hashem punishes those who sin. It includes more elements of calling to God and God responding. And then the latter two chapters, 4 and 5, describe guilt and suffering, but have elements of anticipation of Geula, anticipating that this is going to change, that there's going to be redemption. So what I'm getting at here is that there's sort of elements of an arc, but overall, it's fundamentally suffering. Less intense, more intense, a little bit of anticipation of some kind of redemption, but fundamentally, this is not... There is no arc of, in the beginning we're miserable, and at the end we're happy. That you're not gonna see here. That's just not what Eicha is. The voices in the prakim change, so that it switches from third-person observer in the beginning. Echa yashva v'dar ha'ir rabasiyam. How is it that the city had sat alone and desolate? You're describing something else. To a switch in the first parak. If you jump to Pasuk Yud Beis. Actually, even Pasuk Tes, it's going to be stronger in Yud Beis. But go to Pasuk Tes first. Sentence 9. In Parak Aleph. Right, Tumasav Bishuleha Lo Zachra Harisa. The beginning of the pasuk is like everything before it, which is to say, third person. It's describing what has happened to Yerushalayim. Vaterik Plaim Eimenachemla. There was this deep descent. No one will comfort her. But then, Re'e Hashem Es Onyi Ki Hidilo Yev. See how I suffered. See what has happened to me. Pasuk Yud goes back to being third person, but then you get in Pasuk Yud Aleph, Re'ei Hashem v'habita ki hayisi zolei lo. We want Hashem to look because I have suffered. Things have happened to me. In Pasuk Yud Beis, this shouldn't happen to you. People who pass by and see what's going on to Yerushalayim, it shouldn't happen to you. What happened to me? Yerushalayim herself is speaking, and that's something that you see in the Sefer. It goes back and forth between an outside observer and Yerushalayim speaking, or Yerushalayim being addressed. They're actually speaking to Yerushalayim about what has happened. And again, not so much structure in doing so. It almost feels like the way that an avel speaks. Right? In the sense that when you have someone who is talking about loss, and I don't mean now somebody who is describing something much later on, but someone who actually just suffered a loss, they don't know where to turn. There's no structure to what they describe. Let's say someone, to take the most commonplace, someone suffers the loss of a relative or of a friend. So they may talk about what happened in the end and then go back to how good a friend they were or things that happened back in the old days and then jump from that to talk about the what they meant to them and then talk about their children and then again back to what the last days were like. They go around and around dealing with the dealing with their suffering, not in a systematic and orderly way, but in this very diffuse kind of jumping around type of way, and that's what this feels like to me as you read the Sefer. Having just said that, I'm now about to contradict that. Okay, having just said that the Sefer doesn't seem to have an order in that sense, it just this jumping around of voices and who is speaking. Take a look at the sheet. I gave you something which is the beginning of something, and if you wanted to follow it through, you could see more of it. This describes something that may be familiar to you under the title of Atbash. I think we even mentioned Atbash when we were doing Daniel. It was the code, according to one view, right? The writing on the wall. Good. So for those who aren't familiar, Atbash, right, the first and last letter of the Hebrew alphabet, the Aleph and the Taf, and then Bet Shin, second and next to last, and Gimel Reish and Dalet Kuf, and you can prove you know your Aleph base by going through the rest. But the idea, as it's applied here, is that the first pasuk and the last pasuk of the first parak are linked. And then the second pasuk, and the next to last, and the third pasuk, and the one before that, they're actually linked, working their way inwards. Take a look. It's worth seeing how the opening sentence of the first parak talks about Ha'ir Rabasi'am, right? The city that had been great, but the key word is the word Rabasi. In the last pasuk, Ki Rabos Anchosai. Many are my... Sorry. Last of Aleph. Ki rabos anchosai, my groans are great. Before, my population had been great. Now, it's the groaning that is great. In Pasuk Beis, Yerushalayim is described as crying, and ein lah menachem. She has no one who will be menachem her. In Pasuk Chaf Aleph, the next to last sentence, it's ein menachem li. There is no one to comfort me. The third Pasuk has the Kol Rodfei Siguha, all who pursued, who captured her, bein hamitzarim, between the mitzarim. That's the term that we use for the 3 weeks leading up to Tisha B'Av, but between the Mitzarim was when she was caught. Between the enemies were between the boundaries. And then you look at the third to last pasuk in the parak, and it talks about Re Hashem Ki Tsar Li. That same word as Mitzarim shows up as Tsar in that next pasuk. And then in pasuk Dalet, this is the last one that I'm going to do, but in pasuk Dalet, we're told about the Kohanim, Kohaneha Ne'enochim. Her Kohanim groan, or her Kohanim moan, and then in that pasuk it's Kohanayus Kenai Ba'ir Gavo. It's the Kohanim who are expiring out in the streets. That structure works its way inward as you go through the parak. So my question to you, because I have now been monologuing for 13 minutes, and that's way too long, what's the point? So what's in the middle? What happens? Good. What happens when you get to the middle? Take a look. The middle will be which pasuk? There are 22 letters in the Hebrew alphabet. We can do this. So the middle, technically speaking, is Yud Aleph, right? Because it's right. The people who have two middle names have no middle name, right? You know that. That's the way it works when you have an even number. So what you're really doing here is not so much looking for the middle as what changes in the middle of the parak, and what changes is what we saw a couple of minutes ago, which is the switch to the first person. Yerushalayim speaking. Your opening part is an outsider's description of what has happened to Yerushalayim, and the transition is what starts a little bit in Pasuk Tes, but happens really starting with Pasuk Yud Aleph, is Yerushalayim speaking about her pain. When you do this kind of an envelope structure, which is what it is, you have the first half and then your second half, and there's something in the middle that we're meant to notice, we're meant to build up to and see, that's when Yerushalayim herself cries out. That's what we're meant to notice in the parak. So what you see here is a book that is something of a contradiction, in the sense that, on the one hand, it's all over the place. your themes do not follow a clear arc. The voices change. And at the same time, you have what we noticed last time, which is the uses of the alphabet structure. You know, Aleph, Beis, Gimel. That means someone paid attention to creating this. It wasn't just random grief and moaning and all that, but there's an order to it. And number two, you see this kind of an envelope, which really, the more you look at it, you find it not only in this part, but in the other prakim as well. It means that some level of art did go into this. It isn't just Yirmiyahu spilling his guts on paper. You know, there is theme, there is message, there is meaning to what he's saying and how he's saying it. Clear?
Yeah, but there's no explanation to why he switches. Switches from an outside view to an inside view, talking about what's going on in Yerushalayim. He just does it.
Right.
He's not explaining to us why by giving us this.
No, except that he's trying, I think, to highlight that it's more intense when it's Yerushalayim herself speaking. And what does it say to you when it's, when, because really you have three voices here. You have the voice of Yerushalayim, you have the voice of the outsider speaking about Yerushalayim, and then you have the voice of speaking to Yerushalayim. What does that mean to you? Like, why would you expect to encounter one or the other in this book?
Well, it would be different levels of pain, maybe, but if it's very painful, it perhaps should be Yerushalayim speaking the whole time, or...
Right, and why wouldn't this be an entirely first-person book? Why doesn't Yirmiyahu write this as Yerushalayim herself, the whole way through?
Because then it's not what it's meant to do. She just had to cry. Like, oh, we're reacting.
Maybe.
But you said something, we're comparing this to Adal. Who is the one who's in Adal? Is it us or Yerushalayim? Or is it both?
I think it's both. But I think Yerushalayim most intensely. Right? Yashva Badar Yira Basiyam is Yerushalayim. I could see this on a few different levels, but one is simply the inability of the Avil to speak. Right? When you go back to Eov, where Eov sits on the ground for 7 days and is not able to talk, right? And the Gemara in Moed Katan learns from that when one visits a Beis Avil, you're not supposed to speak first, you're supposed to wait for the Avil to speak, because they may not be ready to have a conversation. To me, that's part of what's going on here. The fact that it takes 9 psukim for Yerushalayim to speak up is because Yerushalayim can't speak in the beginning. It's just, there's too much pain there. It's not that it's not painful for Yirmiyahu, but it's a different experience. He's not ultimately the one that had the splendor and lost it. He is the one who had enjoyed the splendor. And now it doesn't have it. So maybe that's part of what's involved here. But I'm not sure. I'm confused by this book. It's not straightforward. There are certain books in Tanakh that just really require like years and years of study in order to grasp them, and some of them are a lot more fun to do that with. Like Shir HaShirim is great. You know, even Koheles, if you can just, you know, get past sort of the cynicism of it, is great. Who wants to spend hours and hours on Eicha? That's the problem.
If maybe there's something that we can learn about the way you speak about pain versus the way you experience pain, or maybe viewing others or viewing yourself in pain in different ways.
I hear it. I think that it's. I think it's a reasonable thing to do. What that would really require is to sit down with the psukim that are third person, second person, and first person, and ask, okay, where are the differences? Where are the similarities? So now you have your thesis project. Do that, we'll grant you a doctorate. I think that's a serious way to look at things.
May I touch upon last week?
Yeah.
He had this presented to which kid was it? To Yoyakim.
Yeah.
It's not written as a message to Yoyakim in any way?
So the first parak sounds like it should... I mean, that's the part that we assume was the part that was for Yoyakim, was the first parak. So it is a message for sure of what's coming, and this is where your
actions
are brought to. So in that sense, it is a prediction at that point. The problem is that, as we saw then, Yoyakim burns the sefer. And then he says, write it again. And at that point, it's not for Yahyakim anymore. now a message for us. But the original nevuah is not a message to us, it's a message to the king, who, you know, ignores it as...
So he's writing about events that seemingly happened but didn't happen.
At that stage, in terms of, right, it's a prediction.
Right.
No, it's true. It's a prediction at that point, which is a whole other aspect of Yirmiyahu we didn't really touch on last week, but it's worth recognizing. He's walking the streets of Yerushalayim, seeing it in ruins, even as it's still built up. He's walking through the Shuk, and it's alive, and there's produce and everything else, and he's seeing it burning. Like, that's what he sees. And he describes this in the course of Sefer Yirmiyahu. Yirmiyahu is such a remarkable read. If you're not going to read Eicha, at least read Yirmiyahu. That's the... we could have done that for 3 weeks, except it has many more prakim. But it's really an incredible thing to imagine what's like to be Yirmiyahu. He's not like any other Navi. And you can say that for many Navi, that they're sort of a thing unto themselves, but this is Yirmiyahu's unique characteristic. But I told you in the email that this wasn't going to be a like pasuk by pasuk read, because that can be very intense. What I wanted to do was pick out a message from each parak in the book, an image, a message that I think it should be taken in some depth. So in the first parak, pasuk gimel, a very important image. I think it's a very important image at any rate. And therefore it is for our purposes, I suppose. Take a look at the pasuk, please. Galasa Yehuda me'oni u'me'rov avoda. Yehuda went into exile. You know, of course, that Yisrael, the northern kingdom, was gone long before at the hands of the Assyrians. Yehuda, Judea, is the southern kingdom, which is basically Yerushalayim at that stage. So Yerushalayim, Yehuda, went into exile. He yashuva ba'goyim lo matza'a manoach. She lived among the nations. She did not find any rest. And I'm going to pause with that, because the rest of the pasuk isn't what I wanted to seize on. It's this phrase. He yashuva ba'goyim, she dwelled among the nations, lo matza'a manoach. She did not find rest. Yeah. It sounds like the Yonah from Parshas Noach. It sounds exactly like it, and that's why I brought you on your sheet in source number 2, the opening pasuk. V'lo matza'a ha-yonah manoach l'chaf ragla. When Noach sends the dove out of the boat, right? The dove is not able to find a place to rest, and ultimately comes back to the boat, and then he sends it again, and it comes back with the olive branch. Right? We're familiar with this. Good. But it's not the only time we find this phrase of being motzei manoach or menucha. Second reference has to be Rus. Right? In the beginning of Megillas Rus, when after Machlon and Kilion die, and Elimelech has died, and Naomi is coming back to Beit Lechem, she has Rus and Orpah with her. They say, we're going to come with you, and she says, what for? I've got nothing to offer you. Right? We discussed that in the shiur before Shavuos, about what she had to offer, what about the possibility of marrying the Goel, and so on. That's an old shiur, which you don't have to remember any... No, you do have to remember this. But take a look at what she says to them. The second pasuk, but I bring you in number 2. She says, Yitain Hashem lachem, may Hashem give to you, umtsena minucha. You should find minucha, isha beis isha, a woman in the house of her husband. In other words, go find a home for yourselves. And that's the second reference that I can think of in Tanakh to being motzei minucha. And then there's a third one, which you can find a little bit of in Sefer Devarim, but the stronger reference is in Tehillim. And it's talking about something else as a place of minucha. Asher, and this is one of the Shir HaMalos prakim in Tehillim. Asher nishba Hashem nadar la'avir Yaakov. David swears to God, Im avo ba'ohel beisi me'alel eres yitzuah. He says, I'm not going to enter my palace. I am not going to get onto my bed. Im etein shnas le'enai l'chavaytenumai. He says, I will not sleep. Ad emtsa makom l'ashem, until I find a place for God. Mishkanos la'avir Yaakov, a residence for the Mighty One of Yaakov. And then he continues to say, We've heard about it in it being in Ephrata. We found it in the Sdeyar, the fields of the forest. We will come to his Mishkan. We will bow to Hadom Raglav, his footstool. Kuma Hashem l'minucha secha. Hashem, rise up for your minucha. What is this place? What are we describing? Beis HaMikdash, which already back in the Chumash was called HaMenucha and the Nachala. The Menucha is the place where Hashem will rest. Already back with the Mishkan, Hashem said, "Bishachanti b'socham, I will dwell in their midst." It's the place of rest, which shall be found. Mitzanuha b'steyar ad emtsa makom l'Hashem, to be motzei Menucha. So now I have, aside from Eicha, where Menucha is not found, I have three other references to finding Menucha. The Dove, Rus, and the Beis HaMikdash. What is the theme? What is it about these three places? What is it that you're looking for in this Menucha?
To settle after destruction.
Sorry?
Tshuva.
Tshuva's always good. I think that actually all three of those fit here. I think there's an element of safety after destruction, right? I think there you see that here. Obviously, the Yonah after the Mabul, Rus after the loss, you know, of her entire family, and then the Beis HaMikdash, because unfortunately, the way we ended up with a new Beis HaMikdash tended to be the destruction of what came before. Meaning the Mishkan is in Shiloh, right, until it's in Nov. Why does the Mishkan go from Shiloh to Nov? What happened in Shiloh?
Destroyed.
It was destroyed, right? The war in Eli's time, right? The very beginning of Sefer Shmuel. Why does it go from Nov to Givon? Because the city of the Kohanim is destroyed, right, at the end of Doeg. You dynamite the previous one, and then you end up with the next one. The idea here is also, this is an element of sanctuary, of safety, after destruction. So that's one element. What else is it? I think there's an element of support as well. It's not just a place to take shelter, but there's an element of support, most clearly in terms of Rus, you know, trying to find a place, but also the Yonah trying to find food, right? That's what the Yonah ends up finding on the next trip out, when it finds the olive branch. But there's also, to go back to the tshuva idea, the place of spiritual connection to Hashem. The place where you will find that bond seen in the Beis HaMikdash, not in the Rus and Orpah case. Unless we want to read in something that the pasuk doesn't indicate, with the dove you sort of find it. The Gemara is very bothered by the dove. Did I bring it on? I think I brought it on here. The Gemara is very bothered by the dove. What does the dove come back with after the second trip? What does it bring back to Noah? An olive branch. Why did it bring an olive branch? I mean, it's a nice sign of peace now, but that's because of the olive. Back then, that wasn't so initially.
Yeah.
To show that something is growing, right? But why the olive branch?
That's what he found.
That's it? There was just an olive. Olive tree was just the first to grow?
Isn't it? A means of raising something.
So we could look at it in that way. The Gemara takes a different tack. Anybody here ever eat a raw olive? Why not?
They're hard and they're bitter.
Right, they're hard and they are bitter. Says the Gemara, the Yonah is giving Noah a message, saying, "I'd rather have food that is bitter like an olive, but comes from God, than the food that you've been giving us all year long in the boat," which is ungrateful, but it's a dove. You know, really, what do you expect? The idea of the what the Yonah is expressing is, I found a place where I can eat from God. Instead of having to have what you gave me on the boat. You can all go home and have raw olives and see what they're like. But the idea of seeking manoach is about, or seeking menucha, is about more than taking a break. It's about finding that security, finding the support, finding the spiritual connection. What else do we identify within our lives as Jews as menucha? Shabbos, which is about all three. right? Is that not what the theme of Shabbos is, right? When's the first time we are told about Shabbos in the Torah?
The first creation.
No, I mean Shabbos for us. Sorry, I should clarify that. When is the first time we find out about Shabbos as a mitzvah for us?
When
before Hasina. Before Hasina.
Before
Hasina.
Before
Hasina. Before Hasina.
Before Hasina.
Yes, it is. You are right.
What is
Hasina? Nope. I mean, there are midrashim about Shabbos and Mitzrayim, but...
After Mitzrayim, before Isaiah?
Yeah.
What happened
to the Mitzrayim? There's a lot that happened.
In Mara?
There's a lot that happened.
When
they get the Mon. Right. When they get the Mon. When they, you know, on day six, they get a double portion of Mon. The double portion, because we are provided for in advance. Right, that's the idea, is that Hashem says, I'm going to take care of you in advance, and He sends you what you need before Shabbos. That's the element of support that's associated with Shabbos. Security as well, a place to stay, right? We have a law of Tchum Shabbos. Tchum Shabbos is the strangest of halachos. The Tchum Shabbos says, I'm not allowed to travel outside of the town. Not carrying. It has nothing to do with carrying. I can be carrying absolutely nothing. It doesn't make a difference. I'm still not allowed to travel beyond the... Why? What's the point? The idea is, this is your place. This is your place of security. It's the place that is your home. You identify what the Gemara calls Mekom Shvisa, the place where you're going to stop everything and spend Shabbos. It's not a day for travel. And, of course, it's a day for spiritual connection with Hashem. You know, people, it's really very nice when people try to popularize Shabbos by saying it's a day to spend with family, it's a day when you can, you know, shut out the world and just be with your family and your friends and your children, and we should do all of those things. But honestly, that's not the way the Gemara views Shabbos. That's just not it. Take a look at source number 3. Gemara in Yerushalmi, there's a similar version in the Medrash, but I like the Yerushalmi version of it. Lo nitnu shabbosos v'yamim tovim el alasok bahen b'divrei Torah. Shabbos and Yom Tov were given for people to be involved in words of Torah. Amar Rabbi Avo, and Rabbi Avo says, Shabbos Lashem, that's what the Pasuk says, it's a Shabbos for God, meaning Shavus, or Shavos I should say, you should halt, Ka Shem, as God did. What does he mean by that? Now he goes back to the days of creation. We're told that Hashem creates the world with Asara Ma'amaros, with 10 declarations of creation. And then for Shabbos, Hashem stops. Yeah, Hashem stopped talking. So, Ma'akadosh Baruch Hu Shabbos Mimamar, Av'at Shavod Mimamar. The Gemara is telling you, Hashem didn't talk on Shabbos, so you should also not talk on Shabbos. How do you like that? Amar Rabbi Chanina. Rabbi Chanina says, Midocha ki tiru lishol shalom b'Shabbos. He says it was only with great difficulty that they permitted greeting people on Shabbos. And then you get to the line that shocks people always. Amar Rabbi Chia bar Ba. Rabbi Chia bar Abba says, Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, Karabachame le'imei mishtaya sagin. When Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai used to see his mother talking a lot on Shabbos, Hava Amar La, you would say to her, Ema, mother, Shubsehi, it's Shabbos. What was that rude? Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai was very intense. You have to keep in mind
when he saw the people doing menial
things. It wasn't as intense as his son was. Right? His son couldn't back down. Rabbi Shimon. Well, no, first it's him, and then it's his son. But yeah, his son is the one that has a harder time with it. But Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai is on the intense end of things, and I don't think this is a prescription for what you should do in terms of, you know, silencing your parents. Bad idea. In general, not just Shabbos. But it's also unclear here, actually, whether he said this during Shabbos or on Wednesday. He saw his mother speaking a lot. Maybe he said it to her, it was Wednesday. He's like, you know, it's Shabbos, Mom. But in terms of the broader theme here that the Yerushalmi is trying to get across, not to take away from what you accomplish with your family on Shabbos, but to say that Shabbos is really a day for spiritual connection with Hashem, just like the menucha that we had in the Beis HaMikdash, that idea of umitzana menucha. That's the idea. It's different from Yom Tov, interestingly. We're going to talk about Yom Tov in a little bit, but just to, Rav Shimshon Rafal Hirsch has a fascinating point that he makes in his book Chorev. He points out that The Torah's description for the way you celebrate Shabbos is different from the Torah's description of the way you celebrate Yom Tov, in the sense that when we make Kiddush on Shabbos, we quote this pasuk, right? We say, Ata uvincha uvitecha, right? V'avdecha b'amascha, right? But it's your household. You, your son, your daughter, right? That's who's supposed to be in this celebration. When you get to Yom Tov, it adds in V'ager Hashem v'Shev Alevi, V'ager Hayasom v'Almana, all of the different people who may be in need, they should come to you also. So Rav Hirsch argues that Shabbos is supposed to be about meals for your family, that's who's supposed to get together, and Yom Tov is supposed to be about the community. It's a very nice idea. Which I mentioned only to temper somewhat the effect of source number 3, which says actually it's just you and God. But the image that I want to bring out here is the loss of Menucha in Perek Aleph, in Perek Aleph Pasuk Gimel specifically, in this pasuk that we just saw, when Yerushalayim is described as not having Menucha. This is a city that has lost the security. It has lost the support, and it has lost the relationship with Hashem. Follow? That's the idea of loss of Menucha, which parenthetically, the first night of Slichos, the pismon that is said on the first night of Slichos, begins B'motza'ei Menucha, Kidam Menucha, and so on. Which you could read, the simple read, the way that translations will generally read it, which is, it is at the emergence from or the removal of Menucha, because you say it's Saturday night after Shabbos is over, but it's also the Motza'e Menucha. We are the Motza'e Menucha, the ones who try to find Menucha, reading Motza'e as Limtso as opposed to Lotzi. Yeah.
I saw Medrash that said Metzena Menucha refers to husband, but I feel that you could kind of interpret like Yerushalayim lost, it's like a spouse that lost Bisa Mikdash, and then Shabbos is like we're supposed to be like Makala with Hashem. Like there's an idea that there's a reliance on the spouse or the other one. I mean,
yeah.
Expanding on what you said.
Yeah, no, I definitely hear that. I think that's good. Thank you. So that's your first element, and the first element really speaks of, the first image here speaks of just the loss of Menucha and all that goes with it as a theme in Tanakh. Second image, second parak. Take a look, please, at Pasuk Vav. So here, we get a very strong and very upsetting image. Vayachmos kagan suko shiches moado. Who is the he in this sentence? He did violence to his sukkah, his shelter, right? He destroyed the moed. He is God, right? That's a really important point that you see not only in Eicha, it's not the only place, but it's a very important shift. When you describe God as doing bad things to you, right? You've taken the destruction to a new level. No longer is it Hashem allowed me to make mistakes or Hashem allowed the enemy to harm me. Now it's Hashem went looking for a way to attack me. In Shoftim, you actually find that shift at one point from Hashem letting the nations attack us to Hashem bringing nations to attack us. This is very personal. This is what God did in order to cause harm. And specifically, Shikach Hashem Bitzion Moed V'Shabbos. Hashem made Moed, Yom Tov, and Shabbos forgotten in Zion. Meaning, he destroyed them, right? God eliminated Moed and Shabbos. Why would God eliminate Moed and Shabbos?
There's no Bina Mikdash. You can't do the Korbanot for those days.
So you're just saying that God did things, destroying his Beis HaMikdash, his Sukkah, and therefore those things were destroyed. Yeah?
But don't we think that, like, when Hashem destroyed the Beis HaMikdash, yeah, he punished us, but he also punished himself. He's like wandering and he has no home. Mm-hmm. So if, when Hashem got Sukkah, he ruined his own.
Mm-hmm. He destroyed his own building.
He did things to himself. Right. So taking away Shabbos from us, because Shabbos is something that he wants us to have, but he wants to have life.
Mm-hmm. There's, in one of the keynotes, there's a line in which Hashem is described as V'niyesa kitzipor bodeid al gag. You, God, have become like a bird alone on a roof. You know, it's nowhere to rest. In one of the keynotes. I would guess it's the Kina of Ahali, probably, because the Kina of Ahali is the one that describes all the different ohalot, all the different, not tents really, but spaces that we inhabited with God since Bereshis. Includes the tent of Sarah, and includes the tent of the Almoed, and the tent of Moshe, and all these different structures, the Beis HaMikdash obviously, and how they've been destroyed. But I'm not 100% sure. I can send an email out to Elvis later with the when I send out the follow up with the with which Kina it is. But I think that's where it is. But yes, Hashem destroys his own building and therefore gets rid of Moed and Shabbos. But I think there's even something stronger here. Yeah.
So Yantif's a happy time. So you know he took away the happiness, like the joy that he gives us for Yantif.
True. He took away the joy of the Yom Tov, but why? What is it? Why would God destroy Shabbos and Yom Tov?
They don't mean anything to him anymore. He rams and rails against the moment of Yimach HaRotem, right?
Yes, he does. They don't mean anything to him. Even stronger.
That's the way we connect to Hashem.
Yeah.
Like, that's our spiritual connection.
Mm-hmm. And he's saying?
I don't want it.
He's saying he doesn't want it. He's saying he no longer wants the Moed, he no longer wants the Shabbos. This to me is always the absolute worst.
Yeah.
The absolute bitter worst. Take a look in Yeshaya Perek Aleph for a second. Every year, Yeshaya Perek Aleph, if you have a Tanakh. Every year when I was in the Shul Rabbinate, I had to lane Chazon, the Torah for Chazon. And when I came to Toronto, I had the right to refuse. And so I always refuse because I could never get through this line. I always have to stop in the middle of this line. It drives me nuts. The pasuk in Perek Aleph, in which Hashem says, "Mi bikesh zos." You know, take a look. And actually, I might have even brought it on here. Yeah, I did bring it on here. Source number 6. So now everybody can read it.
Yeah,
I refuse to read it aloud. You have to read it on the sheet. The Hebrew is on one side. The English is at the top of the second side. The absolute worst.
Mm-hmm. Well, why is this so shocking? He ended up destroying the Beis HaMikdash. Obviously, it means nothing to him if we don't. Mm-hmm.
I think there's a difference between knowing that God did it and hearing God say it, and to say, "I don't want you in my Beis HaMikdash. I don't want your specifically Moed and Shabbos." Right?
Yeah,
with the Chachem Moadechem, saying that he hates.
Yeah,
you know, it's if you imagine a relationship between two people. Right? You know, for one to say to the other, "I don't want to see you again. I don't want you to come into my house." You know, or even, you know, think, "Kamsa bar, kamsa party. I don't want you at my party, and I'm willing to, you know, to forego your offer of paying for the entire party just that you don't darken my doorstep." I mean, that's harsh beyond harsh. It's really, it's
harsher still is to make sure you don't come back. I'm destroying, I'm knocking down my own house.
Yes. No, it's true, but somehow the verbal to me matters more. The expression of it matters. It says more.
I'm just wondering, in Eicha, why do you think he used the word shikach, like as opposed to?
Yeah, it sounds more like
they forgot, as opposed to they stopped keeping it deliberately.
Well, shikach, the form of it grammatically, right, isn't that they forgot, right? It is.
He caused it to be
forgotten. And the big question in my mind is, who is he causing to forget it? I think it's a very important point you're making. I think I think it's not us. He made it forgotten from himself, which he's God, it can't happen. But I think it's as though this never existed. You know, I think that's what this is. And it's the opposite of the imperative in the Torah. Zachor is Yom HaShabbos L'Kadsho. And all of the Yom Tov are about Zechira, L'man Tizkor. Right? And now, Shikach, he said, all that, gone. As though it had never been. That's the message. And Shabbos, in terms of what we do on Shabbos and Moed, right? It's supposed to be a day of bonding with God in the Beis HaMikdash, right? Uniting with God there. You bring your special karbanos. You commemorate. Right, what do we commemorate on Pesach? Tzias Mitzrayim. What do we commemorate on Sukkot? Well, protection in the midbar. Protection in the midbar. The we bring special karbanos. You even have this nice idea with Shemini Atzeres, right? How on Sukkot you bring all your karban musaf to represent the 70 nations of the world, and then Hashem says, "Stay just one more day, to celebrate with Him alone." And so you have these 8 day with the one karban versus the 70 of the previous. Like it's a day to be with Hashem in the Beis HaMikdash, and Hashem is saying, "Forget it, get rid of it." It's also a day for something else, right? What do we do in terms of our davening on Sukkot that's unique to Sukkot? There's a tefillah that we say on Shemini Atzeres. Well, all through is Hoshanos. Shemini Atzeres is tefillah's Geshen, right? We daven for rain. The Gemara says on Sukkot you're supposed to daven for the year's rain. And then on Pesach, right. We're familiar with Tfilas Tal, but Pesach is supposed to be the time when you daven for the grain for the year, because you're beginning your harvest. And then on Shavuos, you're supposed to daven for the tree fruit, which is going to ripen over the summer. It's a time of special tefillah for our needs, and that's gone. And then there's another dimension, which is our experience on Yom Tov. I already mentioned Rav Shimshon Rafael Hirsch before, but take a look on your sheet number 4. I love this Rambam. This is a great Rambam. Rambam writes in the Laws of Yom Tov, "Kshu ochel v'shoseh, when a person eats and drinks, chayav la'achil la'ger la'yasom v'la'almana, he's obligated to feed the ger, yasom, and almana, we mentioned before, the orphan, the stranger, the orphan, the widow, im sha'ar ha'aniyim ha'umlalim, as well as any other needy people who are around, aval mi sh'noel dalsos chatzero v'ochel v'shoseh hu ubanav v'ishto, but if someone locks his gates, and he just eats himself, his family, and does not feed the needy, does not feed those who are of bitter spirit, that's not the joy of the mitzvah, that's the joy of his belly. That's it." And he goes on to quote Psukim to this effect about this. That's what they're supposed to be about. These are days that are, yes, bond with God, yes, daven for your needs, but they're also days for communal bonding. There's a comment by the Meritz Chias, which I always like to bring on this point. Anyone know what a chaver is? Don't say friend.
Chaver. Somebody
Right. So among in the German Jewish community especially, there was a title of a chaver for someone who was learned but didn't have smicha. It originates in the Gemara, though, as a term for somebody who has accepted personal responsibility for care in Truman Meiser, right, tithing produce, and Toma and Tahara. Somebody who said, "I'm going to accept Chavrus, I'm going to be a Chaver," was somebody who you could trust and you would know their produce, even if it was the same day it was picked, they took care of Truma Nicer already for sure. There's nothing to worry about in terms of Toma and Tahara, everything is fine. And in the going back to the time of the Beis HaMikdash, you would have a very clear divide. You had people who were the Chavirim, the ones who were trustworthy. You had people who were known not to be careful, and then you had intermediate people, and you didn't know what their status was, and you'd have to inquire if something happened, if you wanted to eat somewhere, whatever it is, you have to find out. And obviously this creates divisions, right? Where can you eat for lunch on Shabbos? Isn't just a question now about how they check for bugs. It's a Toman Tahara, and it's a Truman Meiser, and everything else. The issue became especially strong at the time of Aliyah L'Regel. Right? If Jews from all over are going to come to Yerushalayim for Yom Tov, and they're going to run into each other in the streets, you could have serious problems. Are you now going to have stores that are just for Chaverim, right? So that they can shop without concern that they're going to touch somebody who's Tameh, and then they're going to become Tameh, and we'll be able to go to the Beis HaMikdash, things like that. So the Gemara Nida says that the Chachamim created a rule. On Yom Tov, Hakol Chaverim Aim. Everyone has the status of being a Chaver. Everybody is credible, is trustworthy, no matter what. The person who you look at and think they don't even know what the rules of Tumah and Tahara are, doesn't matter, they're Tahor.
Really?
Their produce is fine. Maritz Chius writes, it's because otherwise you would totally lose Yom Tov. because Aliyah L'Regel, instead of being a bonding experience for the Jewish people in Yerushalayim, would become the absolute biggest political nightmare. Yes! Segregated buses for Tuma and Tahara, and it would be the biggest nightmare. And the Chacham said, we're forfeiting, you know, all rules that we normally govern ourselves by in order to make sure that we will at least have Achdus on Yom Tov. That was it. Take a look at number 5, please. The Rambam writes. The Rambam writes regarding the role of Yom Tov. Hayamim Tovim Heim Kulam L'Simcha U'L'Kibutzim She'yesh Lam Hanah She'bnei Adam Tzrichem Aleihem B'Rov V'yesh Lam Tovalas Gamkeim B'Inyan Ha'ahava She'tzarach She'tia Bein B'nei Adam B'Kibutzim HaMediniyim. The Rambam says it. The goal of Yom Tov is to get people together. It's a beautiful thing. And then you read this pasuk, and Hashem says, "I have no desire for your chodesh, your moed, your Shabbos." He throws it all out. He eliminates these things. And so what Hashem says is, "I don't want any of that." And there's a great irony. If you take a look at Perek Aleph pasuk Tesvav, and I know I'm getting to the end, but I started late because of the Allen. I blame the Allen. It's close. But take a look at pasuk Tesvav. Kara alai moed. God did declare a moed for me. What was the moed? Right, once again, Perek Aleph Pasuk Tesvav.
No, we're back in Hebrew.
Yeah, sorry. He called a moed, all right. Lishvor bahurai, to break my youths. Instead of a moed that we would celebrate together, and instead of a moed when we'd be close with Hashem, he created a moed to break us. That was what a moed meant for God. Yeah, there are writers on this who say it's sort of a veiled reference to Tisha B'Av becoming a moed in the future, meaning a happy day. Maybe the straight read of the sentence is that this is irony. Right? I destroyed your moed, and this is what a moed means to me now. That's what it is. But I have to end on a something of a positive note. So I brought you a pasuk here in source number 7. The ultimate promise from Yeshaya. You see it in Yechezkel also, but the one in Yeshaya is the strong pasuk. V'ayam midei chodesh b'chodesho u'midei shabbas b'shabbato. One day, he says, at each chodesh, Rosh Chodesh, at each Shabbos, yavocha basar lishtachavos lefanai. All flesh will come to bow before, meaning to visit in the Beis Hamikdash. Amar Hashem, Hashem promises fundamentally the ultimate restoration of the Chodesh, of the Yom Tov, of the Shabbos. It's gone, but it's not gone forever. There will be a return. So what I hope we got through today, aside from just the structural point and how the book is on the one hand something of a mess in the switch between the voices, and then on the other hand it's structured in terms of the Aleph Beis and in terms of the envelope structure that we saw in the first parak, which again I think has different layers of meaning to it, whether it's the experience of the Avel and how one grieves, or whether it's because there are different lessons to learn from the different voices that are involved. But then we also saw the imagery from the first parak. We saw the idea of not finding manoach, not finding the place of safety and security and support, as well as bonding with Hashem, right? Rus, the dove, Rus, and the Beis Hamikdash, and Shabbos. And second, we saw from the second parak the scorn that's involved from Hashem and the rejection of which is supposed to be so beautiful, the Shabbos, the Moed, the day to bond with God, the day to bond with others, is of no interest to Hashem. And now and the hope that it will ultimately be restored. So what we'll do next week, God willing, is go through images from Perek Gimel, Perek Dalet, and Perek Hey. We'll be back at Hadassah. Thank you again for hosting this week. Even Mashiach coming tomorrow, God willing, we'll still have a shir. So Eicha is still in Tanakh. Keep that in mind. Thank you very much.